So, welcome back, everybody. It is wonderful to see everyone, and Be'ezrat Hashem, I hope that it has been a beautiful Purim for everyone. I'd like to start off just by thanking our sponsors, first of all, for this entire series, to Toby and Nachman Lokshin, who are sponsoring this series, Glimpses of Greatness, on the occasion of the 25th Yahrzeit of Toby's father, Mr. Abram Flesher, Avram Eliezer ben Yehuda Leib, Alav Hashalom, Nishmosai Eden. The family should have continued nachas. Also, I would like to thank the sponsors of this special session, and that is to Andrew and Terry Herrenstein, who are sponsoring today. First of all, in honor of this specific session, the moment this series started, Herrenstein said we have to be part of this, and it is also in honor of the birth of their granddaughter Isla Rosie, who just joined the world just a few short weeks ago. Be'ezras Hashem, she should give you tremendous nachas for years to come. Today we have the very good fortune to be welcoming to our discussion, our dialogue, Mrs. Joanna Ben-Arosh and Rabbi Simon Taylor, who are joining us. For those who do not know yet, Joanna worked for Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks for 24 years. She was Rabbi Sacks's chief of staff when he was chief rabbi, and upon stepping down from his position in 2013, transitioned to run his private office. When you go to rabbisacks.org, that all of that is what you're looking at, is Joanna's work behind the scenes to make it happen. Joanna is a mother of four gorgeous children and a grandmother to a precious granddaughter. I would like to also welcome Rabbi Taylor. Rabbi Taylor should be well known in our side of the world, who is part of our community and has been involved with the office of the chief rabbi in various capacities over the years. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning to think, to gain perspective. Thank you, Joanna, for making the time in your early afternoon on Purim Meshulash, and Rabbi Taylor for being early, late, not depending on how your Sundays usually run. So let's off. By the way, Rabbi Taylor, your background is very consequential. Lovely to see all the Rabbi Sacks books and the many, many more mitzvah shen that we should all have in our library. Let's start at the beginning, just to gain perspective. Many of us here feel very connected to Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks in so many different ways, whether it mean be in the way that we read his works at our Shabbos table, or his books, or we listen to his talks. We feel proud whenever we see him on the world stage. So many of us feel that connection. Joanna, how did you first come into the orbit? How did you first connect with Rabbi Sacks?
So I had the good fortune to be very close family friends with Simmer and Henry Weinberg. And Simmer, actually my sister-in-law, Simmer's from Zimbabwe. She was the director of Rabbi Sacks' office before I was. She was invited by Rabbi Sacks at the sort of early into the second year into his chief rabbinate to be part of an amazing organization that he set up called Jewish Continuity. When he took office in 1991, he realized that the British, like Anglo-Jewish community in Britain, was looking back. They weren't looking forward. And he believed very strongly that in order to grow the community, not just save it and not keep it plateauing, that he needed to do a few shock tactics. And what he did was he wrote a book called Will We Have Jewish Grandchildren? And he took out adverts to sort of kick off this organization in the British Jewish press, which were really shocking. There were a group of sort of teenagers, young adults walking towards a precipice, and one by one they were falling off. And he said, we are losing 10 Jews a day, and we need to halt this now. So Jewish Continuity was set up. It was meant to be to span the whole community. It wasn't just reaching out to the Orthodox community. It was reaching everybody and encourage people to submit their programs for enriching Jewish identity. And out of that came various programs which HUK grew out of here, the Jewish schools programs, various programs grew out of that. But that was in 1993. And Simmer invited me to join the team that began working on this project in 1993. And that's where sort of my life changed. And I think I said to you last week that I think that was the beginning of my journey as an Eved Anglo-Jewry in 1993. And Jewish continuity was exciting. It was new. It was fresh, and brought, you know, lots of conversations around the community. And I was there at the beginning of the creation of that. And it was from there. And then when Jewish continuity then became part of the, you have the UJA federations. We have something a bit different, the UJIA in the UK. And they took over. UJIA in the UK was focused entirely on Israel at that point. But what they did was they subsumed Jewish continuity into their organization in 1997 and started working on looking at education and UK. If you don't have the funders and the people in the UK, chutz la'aretz, where's the money going to come from to support the projects in Israel? That was their thinking. So that was sort of the renewal element. And they UJIA took that in, and I then went to work in the Chief Rabbi's office in 1997. And I will never forget going for my interview with the Chief Rabbi I think it was the beginning of 97. And I was heavily pregnant with my third child. So I really lived Jewish continuity. I had my second child whilst I was working at continuity, and then I was pregnant when I went for my interview, and I had my leg in plaster. I'd fallen off the doorstep trying to juggle everything on the morning school run, and I went for my interview with Rabbi Sachs, and I thought, he's going to think I'm absolutely balmy. Who is this woman? She's pregnant and she's got a broken leg. But I'm still here. And it's been the most exciting and incredible journey. Didn't think I'd be doing something like this at this point in my life. I thought we had a lot more time to be working forwards, but we'll come to that later on.
May I just ask, just as an appendage here, when you talk about shock tactics and, you know, the community, not everybody always responds favorably to being woken up. How did the community?
It was a real mixed bag. So there were some that rose to the challenge, and the younger parts of the community felt, you know, encouraged to think about what their Judaism looked like. And it could have been, it was not just, you know, education programs, far from it. There were cultural programs. The Manchester Jewish Puppet Theatre was funded, all sorts of different programs. But the older members of the community, they came along. They did. I mean, they set it up in such a way that everyone felt included. It was very cleverly done. And he set the ground for it by writing some pamphlets to begin with. But I think, you know, in on the whole, it was a great start.
Incredible. It takes a lot of vision to
absolutely
be able to sort of look a little bit beyond the maintenance and management of the current moment too.
He was looking 25, 30 years ahead, yes, at least.
Right. And would you say now, looking at these 25 years ahead, some of the vision, some of the achievements?
Oh, there's absolutely no question about it. When he took up office, and I say this from the beginning, he didn't do this on his own. There was the most incredible community that supported what he was doing. There were 25% of Jewish kids were in day schools, Jewish day schools. And when he stepped down, I think it was 67%. I'm not sure where it's holding at the moment. But there's absolutely no question. And he touched on all sorts of different aspects, you know, as Chief Rabbi. And I think he left a community that was much, much more sure of itself, was forward thinking and engaged and enlightened. And the programs that the organizations that we have running now, I don't want to, if I mention, then I'm going to forget people, but there's Mizrahi, which is blossoming. The United Synagogue has got an amazing group of programs and inspired leadership. Aish under sort of the Jewish Futures banner. There's just been, you know, as a result, Rabbi Sachs saw himself as a catalyst. So he was felt that he needed to begin things, but he didn't need to finish. So lo alecha, I'm not, and you know, so he started, and people took up that challenge and ran with it.
It's incredible. It's the hallmark of a real leader. So many times you have a leader who just, you know, has to have their hands in every detail, and then never, nothing really ever happens because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Unbelievable. What would you say is one of the highlights of your time with Rabbi Sacks? One of those moments just you always remember?
So there are so many. On the personal side of things, you know, having him address my daughter and son-in-law under the chuppah was just breathtaking, and very, very special for us. Just thinking about it makes me want to cry. Speaking at my younger son's bar mitzvah. But I think also, you know, the privilege of being able to accompany him around the world, meeting various people, building up relationships. I mean, Terry and Andrew, I made the most incredible friendships, and being able to sort of represent him as I'm building up those relationships before a visit. It was just an incredible privilege. I look back over the last 24 years and it's just every part was a highlight. So to pick on certain aspects would be really, really difficult.
Sure. I mean, but like, let's say, like, you know, just thinking aloud, you know, to sort of the Templeton Prize and those kind of those.
Right. So the Templeton Prize was on another level, and I've got a story to tell you about that a bit later on. But that was just, you know, the excitement when he called us in the office to say that he'd won it. We were just beside ourselves, and getting to know the team at Templeton was just phenomenal. We worked with them for over 9 months, and we actually visited their offices in Philadelphia. It was just the most incredible privilege to get to meet these people, to learn from them, and, you know, as I say, to represent him, because in a lot of the conversations he empowers us to just go and do. So we would discuss the big picture with him and the ideas, and then he trusted us to go and have the conversations, to work. I mean, Templeton, for instance, also was they always have it around May. So you have no idea what the juggling was behind the scenes, because it fell during the Omer. So we had to tell, and they like a musical element. So we had to ask them to change the date. Now, this is a huge organization, and the previous laureates have been incredible people. And they said, Rabbi Sacks, what's the date that you need? Absolutely no problem. And as a result of Templeton as well, we asked Prince Charles if he would be involved. He couldn't actually present the prize to Rabbi Sacks, but he hosted us. I don't know if there's a picture behind me. He hosted us in Clarence House for a ceremony ahead of the main ceremony to honor Rabbi Sacks, which was just phenomenal. I remember being introduced to him. I'd actually met him sort of a few years earlier at the dinner that we made when he stepped down as chief rabbi. And I think he said, Rabbi Sacks introduced me to him, and he said, so what do you do? So I said, I'm his chief of staff. And he said, gosh, how do you keep up with him? I said, with difficulty. But just every aspect of working for him has been just phenomenal. If we called to speak to someone, you say you're calling on behalf of Rabbi Sacks. You don't have much of a delay in being put through to the right person.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Incredible. Rabbi Taylor, on your side, what's some sort of highlights?
Well, I just want to reinforce something that Joanna said, which was about empowering the staff. Because one of my favorite personal stories is, you know, Rabbi Sacks works so differently to what people think a rabbi should or shouldn't be doing. He was in his own realm, his own space. He did things very differently. And one of those was that he empowered the staff. And so when I was getting married, unfortunately, he wasn't available to be the Masada Kiddushin. And I was a rabbinical student at the time, and my brother and my friends decided I must have a bachelor's party. This is very important. We wanted Rabbi Sacks to come. So I went to the office of Rabbi Sacks, and Simmer was the chief of staff at the time. And people don't realize, you think that you go and ask the rabbi, but not with Rabbi Sacks, you don't. You are, for the last decade, it's been Joanna. Before that, it was Simmer. And I went over to Simmer, and I told her I'm making a bachelor's party. Would the chief rabbi be able to come? And she had this huge grin on her face from ear to ear. And she said, the chief rabbi would love to come. Right. Now, in the end, he couldn't make it. But it's an anecdote so that you understand how he empowered the staff to make the decisions on his behalf, to the extent from a bachelor's party, you know, to an induction ceremony, whatever it might be. And that to me was one of the keys to how he ran his life and how he was able to achieve so much.
I mean, that sort of opened him up, that freed him up to do what he does best with trust, the necessary trust to be able to build up a team who he...
Yeah. Someone I was speaking to in the last few weeks said to me, he was just, he'd email and come to various meetings. And he always said to me, he said, I could never understand how he could give me his undivided attention when I was in a meeting with him. He never looked at his watch. He never checked the time. He didn't have his phone beside him. And he was totally and utterly focused on me. He said, how did he do that? And I said, because he knew somebody else was watching the time. He knew that when the time came, somebody else would knock on the door. It wasn't his problem. It wasn't his concern. That, you know, we briefed him properly wherever he spoke so that he could be relaxed, that he was addressing that community and talking about the things that bothered and were mattering to them. It wasn't what mattered to him. But all of that went on behind the scenes so that he could come and be fresh and utterly focused on the matter at hand, focusing on the thing that only he could do.
Incredible. Incredible. I feel like so many of us are just juggling all these things, which is why we are the way we are. Well, let's move on to into a different, you know, we on the outside got to see a lot of the public persona of Rabbi Sacks. You know, those of us who were lucky enough to see him in person and those of us who are lucky to read. But what was, if you're sort of just behind that public persona, what was he like a little bit sort of, you know, in the office on a day-to-day basis?
So when we went into the office in the morning, we would have an idea in our mind what we planned to do. It could often get thrown off course, because very often he would have read something in the paper that morning or heard something on the radio, and he called us to discuss what he'd heard. We would probably end up having maybe two or three shiurim a week, because he would pick up on a topic and he said, what do you think of that? How do you think? And guys, are you with me? He was always asking, were we with him? Were we, you know, at the same pace as him? Because I think one of the things that he was concerned about some years ago is that he would often be running and talking at about 80, 90 miles an hour. And the community that he was leading were probably running more at 30 miles an hour. And he needed to come closer to that. So he was always listening and attuned to how people were responding to him. But he was kind, a devoted husband. He always spoke about Elaine every time that he gave a public speech or a lecture, or always, you know, showed such devotion, such an example of a happy marriage. And the concern for us as his team and his staff was unbelievable. He was call when someone wasn't well. And he'd call again an hour later. Any progress, any updates, how are things going? I remember my daughter, Rushi, whose marriage he officiated at, she did very well in her second year of university. And I was telling Elaine just in passing that she'd got three prizes. 3 minutes later, the phone rang. Joanna, I don't understand. You didn't tell me about Rushi's incredible achievements. So I said, well, Rabbi Sack, Chief Rabbi, I didn't need to tell you about it, you know. So he said, can you get her on the phone for me now? I was like, yes, okay. Rushi, are you in a lecture? Can you talk to Rabbi Sacks? But the concern, the care, the thoughtfulness, and as I said, you know, giving time and focusing on people. We had all sorts of requests from around the world, from people asking for his help, whether it was on a private matter or in a community, or And he gave undivided attention, and it was just incredible. He was also totally driven for himself. He set himself targets. He exercised every day, listened to music, which I'll tell you a little bit more about later. Incredible sense of humor, incredible simchas hachaim, a love of life, and not to waste a moment of any day. You know, every day he had well planned out, you know, fixed times for doing certain things. Just an incredible, you know, you can see the way he was driven to produce what he produced. He had very clear ideas in his mind. He compartmentalized, which I'm not very good at doing. So I will jump from one thing to the next. But if I was sitting with him in the car on the way to Thought for the Day or on the way back, he spoke sort of once every month almost on BBC Radio 4 in the mornings, be in the car at 7 a.m. going to the studio. And on the way back, I would always have a list of things to go through with him. And he said to me, Joanna, one thing at a time. Because I would, you know, cross next one thing off the list, but he needed to think about it before we could go on to the next. Very, you know, just incredible. I think I asked him at one stage, did he have a photographic memory? Because what astounded me was that he could quote from anywhere a book that he would have read maybe 20 years ago. He said, no, I taught myself how to memorize and remember things. Wish he'd written a book for us on how to do that.
Incredible, incredible, just incredible. I mean, you know, Rabbi Sacks taught, there's so many just sort of different lessons that he taught, so many different messages that he heralded to the world and to Judah, to Jewry at large. What was one of those that stood out? One of the ones that you felt was really sort of a hallmark of him?
So I think for us, and for me personally, the preparation that he put into absolutely everything that he did, you know, people thought that he could just stand up and deliver. And he probably could, but he never, ever did. He was prepared, whether it was a 3-minute short video or a sermon or the TED Talk or the Templeton Prize speech. Everything went through thorough preparation, and never was it a first draft that you would hear. He wrote things again and again and again. He called us his R&D department. He called himself, sorry, his R&D department. He was the research and development. He would ruminate over issues and matters and ideas in his mind until he was happy that they were something that he could share with others. I mean, one of the highlights of being with him, sort of traveling, was going, I wasn't with him for the TED Talk, but I was with him for the rehearsal. So TED, you know, I don't know if you know that the TED Talks are, they're perfection themselves. And that's because TED puts so much time and effort into their speakers. Number one, in who they choose to speak. But secondly, into how they deliver their speech. TED don't like you to bring notes or anything onto the stage. They prefer you not to have a stender. They want you to be hands-free, if you like, and roaming the stage and being free with your thoughts. So you memorize your speech. Some people use slides, but we prefer, Rabbi Sacks doesn't, because that can go on to a whole nother level. So we told him no slides, no PowerPoint presentations, thank you very much. But he revised that speech again and again and again. And in a conversation with Chris Anderson, he revised it again until he was word perfect. And I went with him to the rehearsal, and they encourage you to come sort of an hour earlier than your allotted time so that you can hear the person before you in their rehearsal. And I was, he and I were absolutely sort of really shocked, because the person in front of him, before him, was Ray Dalio, who is one of the largest hedge fund owners in the world. And his TED Talk, it was amazing, but they gave him 20 minutes of feedback for an 18-minute presentation. They literally took him to pieces, told him how to put it back together again, and on the day he was stunning. And Rabbi Sacks and I sat there thinking, what's going to come for him? Anyway, he was word perfect on the day and at the rehearsal. They couldn't make a comment on his speech. He was incredible. But afterwards, Chris Anderson came up to him and said, "Rabbi Sacks, that was phenomenal. Don't change a word. It was incredible." He said, "Just can I ask you about your dress, your mode of dress?" And because Ted likes to be informal and relaxed, and you know, so he said, "You know, could you lose the tie? Would you mind?" And I'm sitting behind him, and Rabbi Sacks can't see my reaction, but Chris can. I'm sitting there shaking my head, and so he says, "Chris, let me tell you, I promise you, I'll stick to the rest of the dress code, and I won't wear any dangling earrings, but my tie stays." And the room just erupted. And he said, "Okay, Rabbi Sacks, you keep your tie." But the research, I mean, the preparation that he put into that to be word perfect would have been days and days and days and days of work.
It doesn't just happen. It's so interesting. So many people sometimes think, you know, when it comes to other forms of art, other forms of expertise, that you would never ask somebody to just, you know, perform. Sometimes think, you know, rabbi or photographer, sometimes I just take a picture. Exactly.
That's
not how it works at all.
No, it doesn't. I speak to his rabbi in Golders Green. That's his local community where actually he was the Rav some years ago. And I said, I would ask him sort of in the summer when the rabbi was away, he'd call me and say, would Rabbi Sacks be able to speak instead of me, give this the sermon in Shul? So, you know, I would discuss it with Elaine and Rabbi Sacks. And afterwards, he would say to me, he said, "I always have one tucked in my pocket just in case." So that was the level of prep. You know, never go into Shul without just knowing, just in case, I've got a sermon there. It's just...
It's a certain level of respect for the people you're speaking to. That you
exactly. Yeah.
They deserve something, and you deserve to be.
Exactly, 100%.
Rabbi Taylor, on your perspective, what was some sort of like hallmark teaching or something that really he represented?
For me, there was one of his big hallmarks happened to be reshared with the world just, you know, a number of weeks ago on Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg's Behind the Bima, which I'm so, so happy that got released because the nuggets within that were just priceless. And I spoke to Joanna about it. She remembers it all. She was there when it happened. And, you know, he speaks about this idea that when it comes to material possessions, the more you give, the less you have. But when it comes to the spiritual realm, the more you give, the more you have. And he was always encouraging others to share their Judaism, to share it with those around them, to share it with those other people in the world. And that's going to help you on an individual level. That's going to help you with your own Judaism. And he didn't want to be this lone soldier, you know, this lone diplomat and, you know, for the Jewish people with his incredible eloquence and writing. He wanted everyone to join him and get involved and be a part of that. And but it wasn't just that he needed more, you know, more people in his army. He believed that was going to help you to be a better person, to be a better Jew, you know, to have more pride in your own Judaism. And you know, that for me, and this was advice that he got, you know, a long time ago. And this is advice he'd give to many people on an individual level that was struggling to go out there and to share and to teach. And that for me was really fundamental. And like I said, I'm so happy that it came out with clarity and that Behind the Bima, they got very large exposure. So everyone knows that, you know, that part of his, you know, of his teaching. And like Joanna said, you know, it's not, he didn't feel it was his job to do everything. It's more of his job to get things started. And, you know, the same with everyone else. He wanted everyone else to, you know, to get stuck in. And even this week in Covenant and Conversation, I hope everyone's read it. You know, he speaks about leadership as giving everyone else an opportunity to participate, to get involved, to do their bits. And that was always his style. And of course, it's very difficult now to, you know, to figure out who's going to pick up the mantle of, you know, he's taken, you know, now it, without him here, you try and think, well, who's going to fill that void, but that was something that he was always preparing for, trying to get others to join him and be a part of his mission.
Wow, that makes so much sense. I mean, just in all of his writings, that idea, that seems to just be a theme, you know, that difference between power and influence, and power dividing, influence increasing. And that resonates. That makes sense. That wasn't just a thought, that was a lifestyle.
Yeah, the main quote, you know, from this one, right, you know, is many short quotes, but Judaism is God's call to responsibility. And that really was the theme that ran through all of his writings, about that responsibility that he so clearly took with every speech that he gave, every book, everything that he did. And that's what he was trying to pass on to the world, to every single young Jewish person who was trying to shake them, wake them up. You know, you have to take responsibility for your own Judaism, for your own life. That, you know, that's the main part of this. Again, there's so many teachings, but that's the core theme that really runs through everything.
Well, while we're on the topic of books, if we could just put it in that way, Joanna, what was your favorite of the, I mean, he published so many different books and pamphlets, yeah, and essays. What was your personal favorite of the many?
So it's really difficult to have a personal favorite, because there's personal favorites of lots of different books. So, you know, I think like Rabbi Taylor was saying, you know, that he wanted to share his knowledge with as many people as possible, to encourage them to share, to live their Judaism and to share with others. And I think, you know, so he wrote his books with others in mind. He always used to say to us, I'm writing a book to answer a question I have, which I think is amazing. So, you know, the religion and science, the great partnership, so many people, so many kids sort of doing science, you know, they really struggled with how to be from and yet follow the science, you know, follow science. And he explains it in the most accessible, incredible ways. And, you know, what we felt also was that there are times when people won't necessarily pick up a book, but how can we distill those messages that he does so brilliantly in a book into shorter pieces? So Rabbi Taylor's got behind him Radical Then, Radical Now, which in America is a letter in the scroll. Exactly. And the whiteboards, the first whiteboards animation we did was taken from there, Why I'm a Jew. And it was, you know, because we need to share those messages as widely as possible, make them as accessible as possible. Morality, we did a whiteboard animation for that as well. Morality is was almost prophetic. When he wrote it, we were not in a pandemic. For the American edition, there's an afterword. But he could see that society was fragmenting. And how do we've got to, you know, I think it started ruminate. The ideas actually started way, way back. But he talked about them in the TED talk. He talked about them in the Templeton speech. He spoke at Chautauqua one year. And all of those ideas, he did an amazing series for the BBC on morality. And all of those ideas permeated into the book on morality. You know, we need to think about the we, not the I. You know, we became totally self-obsessed from the selfie onwards. And I think it was such an important message for all of us. You know, it's like you're thinking about your values on your tombstone. Are they, you know, what kind of values do you want? What do you want people to remember you for? Do you want to be remembered for how many cars you had in your drive, or what holidays you took, or how kind you were, and how you gave tzedakah, the kind of people that you touched along the way? And those were all the things that he was thinking about whilst he was writing most of his books, and inspiring others to live a Judaism that they could be proud of. The Letters to the Next Generation pamphlets that he did were really for youngsters, you know, worrying about what was next in their lives. Just he had a way of touching people where they were. So when you read a book, you thought, he's written it just for me. Or you read the essay at the beginning of the Siddur on prayer, or the Machzorim. I mean, like, he had the most incredible talent, and the canon of work that he's left us, this phenomenal legacy. It's breathtaking.
I think so many of us feel that, you know, when you, it's almost, as you said, it was almost written just for us. And there's so many different kinds of people, but each of them find their own way of accessing that. Right, Taylor, on your side, what's something which really resonated with you?
Sure. For me, it's really Rabbi Sacks's Torah ideas through covenant and conversation, where, you know, he takes the themes from his books and you see those resonate through his Torah, which he's sharing, as well as the commentaries of the Siddur and the Machzorim. I love those. But I think what's so interesting is so many of Rabbi Sacks's writings, although he might have said, Joanna, that they were, you know, for him, he felt a responsibility to share with others where there was a need, right? If there was a world event that happened, he felt that there needed to be a Jewish response, and he had to do it. If there was, from the Siddur to the Machzor, if it was outdated and there needed to be a new commentary that spoke to this generation, he had to do it. Yes, he was grappling with it himself, but he had to get it out there and put it out. I once heard, Joanna, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this or you can clarify, but someone once said to him, why is the chief rabbi not putting out a weekly parasha sheet? It's not befitting. You got to do it. So he said, okay. And the next week he started. And that's why we have covenant and conversation, right? If someone said there was a need, that need, he took that the responsibility on his shoulders. And for me, I suppose the shame is that on a selfish note, I wish he just would have written Torah thoughts all day for me, but that wasn't his calling. That wasn't his primary responsibility. He knew he had to write for the world. He knew he had to be the ambassador for the Jewish people. He knew there were other priorities. So that's what he wrote. And so, we got the Torah ideas in between. And those, I value those. They're so precious.
I think what he did was, even in his secular books, he wove the best of Judaism with the best of Western society. So he showed you how you could be a proud Jew and live in today's society. And all of his, even morality, but definitely not in God's name. And all of his books are infused with a proud Judaism and what can Jewish moral and values bring to wider society. Why did people come and seek his advice from all walks of life?
It's so true. I wish every politician today could read morality. By the way, books, it's in Judaica Plus, just down the road from us. It's really worthwhile. So, as you said, Jordan, it's prophetic in the sense that the things he talks about are exactly what, were exacerbated during Corona. And even with the epilogue, which explains it, it's like he's talking about what would just happen it just all happened.
It's like the we in society. It showed the best, and the virus has shown the best and the worst of society. From at the beginning, the run on toilet paper. I don't know if you had that in the States, but it was ludicrous here. Literally, the shelves were cleared. To people creating WhatsApp groups for people in their streets and going shopping for those that were more vulnerable. So you had the complete juxtaposition of society, and it was like, and the book came out at that time.
That's a cusp, right? Just unbelievable. How is it that he managed to say, stay so humble at the same time as being, like, when you're a public personality, you sort of, there's a limelight. How did he manage to balance all of that?
Yeah, it's so. I think I'm going to do something which I never really do, but quote Gemara and Megillah 31a teaches us in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that wherever you find the greatness of the Holy One, blessed be He, there you will find His humility. And I think that's what struck us so much about Rabbi Sacks. He never fully realized, or he was reluctant to realize how great he was, despite others. Us and others telling him. I mean, you could walk through the street and people would stop. Jerusalem, you could not walk through the old city more than two steps without him being tapped on the shoulder. Even on the tube in London or in the House of Lords or just in the street. And, Dan would walk him through New York, and people would like stop and look. Yes, you can come and say hello. Yes, it is Rabbi Sacks. And then when he spoke to great audiences, you know, he'd walk out and he said, you know, why did they come in to listen to me speak? And it was just, it was breathtaking, that humility. But just a small story to share with you, around the time of the Templeton Prize. So we got to know the team very well. And there were sort of a team that came when Prince Charles gave us the, gave him the award. And then the bigger team came when we did the big award in London. And Rabbi Sacks, I think Elaine, myself, Dan, and two of the Templeton team were in a taxi going from, they put on dinners around the time of the prize with various people. And we were going from one place to another in a big taxi with them. And it was six seats. So there was three and three. So we were facing each other. And the lady from the Templeton Prize was sitting next to me. And she said, I'm sitting here and I'm pinching myself that I'm in a taxi with Rabbi Sacks. And I said, this has been my life for the last 20 whatever years it was at that point. And, you know, I pinch myself every day that I have this incredible privilege. And she looked at me and she was like, that's incredible. And Rabbi Sacks turned around to me and he said, are you serious? So I said, 100%. He had no idea that anyone should feel the privilege of working with him, of learning with him. It was just, you know, quite incredible to see that level of humility. You know, it's, and I, you know, to this day, you know, it's the same. So that was, that was a real eye opener.
Yeah, I definitely remember watching his humility many, many times. And that my first memories of Rabbi Sacks was him staying at my best friend from elementary school's house, the Goldbergs in Edgware. You know, they lived in a regular three bedroom side by side. And he wanted to stay there because it was family when he could have stayed anywhere. And, you know, there would be all the police vehicles would be outside the street and they'd make such a big fuss. And he just wanted to be a regular guy staying with his family. And that really was the beginning for me of understanding exactly who he was at a very young age. You know, in England, we have the royal family and then you have the chief rabbi, you know, and he made it. And Rabbi Sacks really made it, took it to this another level, this aura. And, you know, the shock for me when, again, I was quite young, we went on a Pesach program in Israel and we would watch Rabbi Sacks do his walks that Joanna alluded to because he cared about his health in his shorts and his T-shirt. He'd be walking around and everyone would be scratching their heads thinking like, is that really Rabbi Sacks? Did I just see him like go to the tennis court? You know, you see him as royalty. And, you know, like we mentioned, the tie for the TED talk, and you see him walking around. And even in Israel for himself, he would, you know, walk around in a short sleeve shirt with no jacket and no hat. It wasn't your stereotypical chief rabbi that needed the full garb, you know, in any way. And, you know, Joanna once arranged this incredible experience for me. In 2015, Rabbi Sacks came to speak at the BBYO International Convention. And the fact that he was asked to speak is remarkable in and of itself. It's a completely secular event where they really are just looking for Hollywood stars. And, you know, which Orthodox rabbi would get an invitation to speak at that conference? I don't know. Only him. And it was really, the whole thing was remarkable. You had 3,000 screaming teenagers and they introduced Rabbi Sacks. His introduction was very, very long. And by the time he got up onto the stage, the kids were all screaming and going crazy. And I think it's the only time I've ever seen Rabbi Sacks shorten one of his speeches like that. You know, most rabbis, they've prepared their speech and they've got a big crowd and everyone's going to be quiet and they're going to listen. And he realized that this was not the right place for him to give a drasha. And so he gave something very short and he gracefully walked off the stage. Like it wasn't about him. It wasn't about his speech. And, you know, then thanks to Joanna, we had a nice private meeting with the NCSY staff afterwards, which he spent a lot of time on. But he was different. He had this very special type of humility where he just, you know, carried on as as normal in the way that he'd want to do as a regular person. And I think when it comes to the quotes, again, one of my quotes, I think it's also from Radical Then, Radical Now, is that, you know, Judaism changed ordinary people to having extraordinary lives, something like that. And I don't think he ever thought that he was included in that quote, right? He was the ordinary person, right, who was lucky enough to be the chief rabbi and write some books. But the extraordinary lives, that was other people.
Yeah.
That's so interesting because, you know, you see this with very famous people, is they became, you know, dependent almost on their crowd base because that's their identity. And that's not at all.
No.
At all.
He actually said to us once, we were probably reading him one of the letters that had come in or something. He said to us, compliments are fine, so long as you don't inhale.
That's so true. That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Don't let it go to your head.
Wonderful. Joanna, would you be willing to share something, you know, that we just, as outsiders, couldn't possibly know, you know, about Rabbi Sacks?
So, he has an absolute love of music, just, and the breadth and eclectic taste was incredible. So he would love everything from pop music all the way to Chopin or Beethoven and everything in between, including a breadth of Jewish music. He loved all music, but he was someone who didn't take anything at face value. He wanted to know what was beneath the surface. So he would know all sorts of facts and figures about music, that a piece of music that you'd have no idea what was behind it. But he wanted to know who was the artist, what mood was he in when he wrote that piece of music? How long did it take him to create it? What was special about it? That was he influenced by anybody else? And I have a sort of a funny story, because I, at the beginning of when I joined his office in 97, I think it must have been fairly soon after, I have a touch of being able to fix computers. So I'm not very good on the sort of the innards of a computer, but programs and stuff like that, when it's not working, I can sort them out. Sometimes don't hold me to it, but I was probably up in his study in Hamilton Terrace, the residence of the chief rabbi, and I was fixing something, possibly under his desk, something had come under, I don't know. My phone was in my handbag on a chair way behind me, and normally it was on silent, but for some reason it wasn't. And my ringtone at the time, I don't know if you've heard of the pop group Queen, but it was Bohemian Rhapsody, and it blared out, and I was so embarrassed. So I sort of jumped up, ran to my phone, turned it off, and chief rabbi at the time, he looked at me, he says, "Joanna, I didn't know you liked Queen." I said, "Chief Rabbi, I didn't know that you knew who Queen was." And I think it was just incredible to hear, you know, that he had an appreciation. And then he proceeded, obviously, to tell me how Bohemian Rhapsody was made. And it was, you know, it was a trailblazer of its age. I think it was made, I think someone will correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was made in 1974, I think. And it had to be dubbed 180 times. He knew, and he'd heard it for 1 second on my phone. Well, it was a little bit more than 1 second. Incredible, the depth of an appreciation, and you know, a quote from him, "Words are the language of the mind, music is the language of the soul." And that's what he believed, you know, that we, for our souls to breathe and enlarge. And, you know, that's why davening is, you know, the parts of davening that which are so meaningful to us are not just the quiet, silent ones, but the ones we sing together as a community. And he very much believed that music was integral to us as human beings. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's something I remember, Taylor. I think you mentioned like something I got in your article as well about like singing and being involved with teens. And it's so interesting because you imagine that when you look at great intellectuals, they live in this ivory tower of intellect and thought, and the heart is a very different space. And for it to bridge that is quite remarkable. For those who are not aware, folks who are watching, Rabbi Sacks put out a lot of beautiful music compendiums. You can find on the office of the chief rabbi, rabbisacks.org. I'm still in that zone. So Israel, the home of hope, was a CD he put out a number of years ago, and on the Yomim Naraim, beautiful compendiums of artists he pulled together. And annotating, it's unbelievable. I didn't understand and appreciate it until you really said that.
Yeah. He really, it was an integral part of who he was, and we were constantly learning. He introduced us to sort of older members of your community might know of the Traveling Wilburys. I'd never heard of them. He showed us a video on YouTube. You know, just phenomenal. This man read and listened to absolutely everything, to absorb information and knowledge, and to be able to share that with the world. It was just, you know, absolutely phenomenal.
It's almost as if he was the filter of meaning for everything that he experienced. One of the things that, you know, for us, I know I speak for myself, but you know, the Shabbos table being with Rabbi Sacks's thoughts, whether it be covered in conversation or his other writings. You know, so many of us were so excited when we heard that the Covenant and Conversation is continuing this year, 5781. But, you know, I guess in the back of our minds, we have this fear of what's going to be with the office of the Rabbi Sacks and the continued writings. There's so much, as you said, the canon. Where's that going?
So we've been working on a strategy for his legacy. To enhance and develop. I mean, even if we did nothing, his legacy is there, but we feel very strongly that we need to share that as widely as we can and for the next generation to be able to learn from Rabbi Sacks. So we're hoping that we will be able to develop resources based on his teachings for formal and informal educators in the future to use in schools and youth groups, etc. And also for, you know, in adult education, we know that teachers are hard pressed to make resources for themselves. So we want to make this as easy and as accessible as we possibly can. We'll be developing a new website where everything will be easily searchable by topic. There's a lot of work to do to make sure that his work continues to be accessible to all and for everyone to live and breathe Rabbi Sacks's Judaism, which I think is so important. I was talking to someone fairly recently, and I think this sort of embodies our feeling. He said when Rabbi Alex Israel, he said when he gives a drasha or a sermon or a lecture, he doesn't know where his Rabbi Sacks's teachings end and his carry on. And I think that's what we want. We want to, you know, hope that embed Rabbi Sacks's teachings into his future Talmidim and Talmidot and our future generations to always be learning from him.
That's so hopeful. It was like what you were saying before as well, is that the idea of sharing. It's not that he had the trademark on all this wisdom. He wanted us to be part of the sharing process. So it doesn't really stop. That's extremely hopeful and inspiring. I would just say, like, you know, as you can draw to a close now, perhaps I could ask both of you, is that, you know, he may have viewed himself as an ordinary person, but he certainly was no ordinary person to the world, to Judaism, and as a human being. How do we, more ordinary folks, what's something we could do, what we could change in our lives, we could adopt in our lives that would be just a little bit more like the world that he hoped for?
Rabbi Taylor, why don't you go first?
Sure, that's a good idea. My internet's a bit jumpy. I hope everyone can hear. So first of all, I think a simple thing is... hang on.
We can hear you.
Okay, great. So a simple thing is to stay above the fray. You know, something that we haven't spoken about is that Rabbi Sacks didn't feel the need to get involved in machlokas, and if people attacked him, he just stayed above it. And I think it's something that we all need to do more and should do more. But really, to me, is to take the lesson from him, which is that I think he wants everyone to grapple with their own Judaism. Judaism shouldn't be something we do by route. It shouldn't be something which is one-dimensional. It's something that we should constantly be grappling with the text and with the ideas and on an intellectual level is the one part. And then on the other side is to infuse your Judaism with a soul, with a neshama. You know, with that music that Joanna spoke about, you know, it can't just be on the intellectual side. And I think that Rabbi Sacks, having that intellectual element together with that incredible soul and neshama that he put together, so really constantly working on those two is the magic. And I think once you blend those two together, then you get the love and the pride to share with everybody else. And I think that was, you know, Rabbi Sacks's formula, which he wants everyone else to have. Now, of course, the one bit which we might be a little bit more ordinary and there's not much you can do. Okay, so his brain capacity might have been a little bit higher than everyone else's, but the formula is still the same. And again, I think what made Rabbi Sacks so special, which I think we can take, is that he was able to, every time he spoke, he never spoke above people's heads. Like Joanna said, he always was ruminating the ideas. It wasn't because he was ruminating the ideas for himself. He was ruminating how he makes sure that everyone else can understand what's in his mind. Because there's no point in speaking if it's not helpful. There's no point in passing something on if the people in the room aren't with you and can't understand the message that you want to share. So, you know, it doesn't matter how smart you are or how smart you want to show people you are. As long as the main thing is to make that difference and to make sure that people can hear, understand, and internalize your message. So you know, for me, that's really the key. And as Joanna said, like, I've reached that stage where I don't know what's mine and what's Rabbi Sacks's. It's from as young as I can remember, I've been, you know, all his ideas are imbued in my mind, the way that I live as a Jew, the way that everything that I do. And so I can't, you know, deconstruct the different pieces. And that's really what, you know, is what we're trying to achieve. So, you know, I bless everyone that they should reach that point. And I'm pretty ordinary, so I think everyone can do it.
Thank you.
So I'll just give you a sort of a couple of quotes actually from this year's Covenant Conversation, which is the lessons in leadership. And he said, to be a leader, you don't need a crown or robes of office. All you need to do is write your chapter in the story, do deeds that heal some of the pain of this world, and act so that others become a little better for having known you. And he always talked about writing that chapter in the book. So you go into a library and he'd make it so visually clear. You walk into a library and you pick up a book from the shelf and you can see it's got your family's name on the cover. And then you open it and you see all your ancestors have written chapters and there's a blank page with your name on it. What are you going to write in the chapter? Are you going to continue this incredible journey that your ancestors have taken? Because that's your role, is to take it to the next generation. And then, and the other thing that he said to us very clearly was, you know, leaders see the destination, begin the journey, and leave behind them those who will continue in it. That was, that's enough to endow a life with immortality. He wrote that. That came out Chayei Sarah the week that he passed away. And if that wasn't his message to all of us, I've started. You've got a job to carry on. It's, we're unbelievably blessed to have been so close for so long and it's been an honor, the honor of my life to play just a small part in Rabbi Sacks' legacy, but he was the leader who saw the destination and began the journey, and it's now up to all of us to continue.
Wow, this has been incredible. I feel like we could all of us listen for hours and hours and hours and learn and continue, but this has been such an inspiration. Joanna, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing, and we're going to take that torch and go forward, God willing. God willing. Rabbi Taylor, thank you for bridging the continents and for bridging the messaging. And the Ezra Hashem, we should continue to teach and live the legacy and the life that he represented.
Amen.
Thank you so much, Ruth, for joining.
Thank you.
I want to tell you.